Welcome to another episode of the Grilling Truths NFL Legend Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mow, a new interactive football app. Make sure you check out Gridiron Mow at www.gridironmow.com. I'm your host, as always, for the Legend Show, Mike Goodpaster. Very special guest today. I know we've had guys like Robert Brazil, Tom Flores on in the past that I believe should be in the Hall of Fame, and we've got another one today. My guest today was one of the finest defensive backs in the history of the NFL, was named to the 1960s All-Decade Team, eight-time Pro Bowler. Help me welcome to the show former Los Angeles Rams defensive back, Eddie Metter. How you doing, Eddie?
Oh, doing just fine. How are you?
I'm doing great.
It's a little bit cool here, but we're beginning to warm up a little today.
Where you at? You still in Texas?
No, I'm in Virginia.
Oh, Virginia. All right. Yeah. I'm in the Midwest. We're still shoveling snow, so.
Mm-hmm. Well,
all right.
I've been here about 25 years.
Yeah. All right. So can you tell us what life was like growing up in Texas? We know how big high school football was there. Tell us some of your early influence. I also read that you played a little bit of 7th and 8th grade football, didn't play in high school until you were a senior.
Yes, that's basically true. And I was in 7th and 8th grade in Texas and played football there then. And then our family, we moved to Arkansas from Texas. And I moved to, I was ineligible to play my sophomore year in high school because of the move. And so then I started playing in my junior year, and I broke my hip before school ever started. Actually, was in training camp, and consequently, that knocked me out of my junior year of football in high school. And so then I was fortunate enough to everything go smooth for me my senior year. And that's the reason that I missed so much football really growing up.
Yeah, what made you decide to play your football at Arkansas Tech?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I really wanted to go to Texas A&M. Back when Bear Bryant was a head coach down there. So I went down for a weekend, and they looked at me and said I was too small to play in the Southwest Conference. So that was that for me, I felt. Came back home to Arkansas and tried to go to the University of Tulsa, and they had the same problem with me. So at that point, I was about 185 pounds, I guess, they were running back. And I said, well, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't afford to go to college other than working and having to go, too. So, but anyway, the fellow who was my high school coach in Russellville, Arkansas, had moved up to an assistant coach at Arkansas Tech, and he talked the head coach into giving me a full scholarship. So, by golly, I took that and ran with it, and everything else is falling into place like it actually was supposed to, I guess.
Well, you had a highly decorated college career. You want to highlight some of your most memorable moments for us?
Well, I felt like, you know, after I did get they did offer me the full scholarship that I sure had better take what I could get, and I did. And at this point, really, you know, I'm kind of glad that I did because Arkansas Tech at that time was about like a 4A high school, and it was, you know, you pretty well knew everybody that was going to school. Everybody was in your class or whatever. So, but anyway, and it was a good, I guess, a good lesson for me to take what I could get, and I was awfully proud of that, and things did go, and I did something besides just football. I was ROTC commander in my senior year in high school and college, and there was a lot of other things, I guess, that I was fortunate enough to receive over the 4-year period. And then I had prepared myself to go into the military service and have that as a career because of the ROTC program.
Yeah.
And then I was drafted by the Rams. I was fortunate enough to play in a ball game in Arizona that was a major college. It was called the Optimist Bowl at that time.
Yeah, I believe John Madden was on your team also, wasn't he?
Yeah, John Madden was there with us, and there were several others that did go into the professional ranks. But I was fortunate enough to play in that ball game, and then Eddie Cotell, who was a scout for the Rams at that time, was there at the ball game. And I guess he took maybe a liking to me. Maybe it was because of the first name or whatever. I don't know. But I was drafted by the Rams in the 7th round that year. And from there, I went on to the Rams. And then I had a pretty rough time getting out of the obligation that I had as far as the military was concerned. And fortunate enough, that was between the Korea and Vietnam conflicts. And there wasn't a real demand at that point for military people. And so I was fortunate enough to write to the 4th Army headquarters and tell them my situation. And they changed me from a 3-year obligation to a 6-month obligation, and by golly, that's where it and the entry date would be to so that I wouldn't miss a year in 1959. So from that point, that's how my professional career actually started.
Yeah, and as you said, the Rams drafted you in 1959 with the 7th round pick. You became a starter right away. The NFL named you the Defensive Rookie of the Year. Was there any players that kind of took you under their wing to help you make the transition?
I don't know. Back then, it was, I guess, a completely different situation than it is today. I don't know what it would be like today going out as a rookie, but we had some hazing, you know, like you would as a freshman in college or whatever. I guess the man that really took me under his wing more than anybody else would have been Les Richter.
Yeah,
Les was a middle linebacker with the Rams, and he and I became roommates after 3 or 4 years, and then when he left, Jack Pardee and I roomed together for the remainder of of my career.
All right, and when you got there, the head coach was soon-to-be Hall of Famer Sid Gilman. What was it like playing for a coach like Sid Gilman?
Well, I guess because I was somebody fresh out of college and I really looked up to him, and he was a good football coach. The thing that really happened, I think, to the Rams in 1959 was the fact that prior to the 59 season, the Rams traded 9 ball players for 1 ball player, and those 9 players that went to the Cardinals was some pretty doggone good football players, and they were all, basically all of them were starters for the Rams, and that really tore the Ram team up, I think, in my opinion, at that time.
Yeah, and that hurt them for some length of time also. I mean, your first 7 years there, I don't think you guys had a winning record. Then George Allen arrives in 1966. Rams had their first winning season. I believe you guys were 8-6. What did Allen do to turn around that team, to change the culture of the Rams?
He just was, in my opinion, 120% man for football, and he demanded that you learn as much as you possibly could learn from him and his assistant coaches, and practice what he was preaching to you, you know.
Yeah.
And he just was a superman as far as a head coach is concerned. He thought 120% football. You'd go in the morning and meet him on the street, and just, "Good morning, coach." I said, "Boy, you got to watch that number 48. You know, he's going to be a really tough football player." That was his answer for good morning.
Yeah, all football, all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, 1967. We actually did a show on here, me and Matt Andrews Gavage, who's a normal co-host. We did a show on the 10 best teams that never made it to the Super Bowl. You played on a team that finished in my top five. That was the 1967 Rams. Only lost one game. You guys in the regular season beat the Packers, Cowboys. I believe, like I said, you were one of the greatest teams not to win a championship in NFL history. Can you talk a little bit about that season?
Yeah, that was a super year for us, and also in 69 was another pretty doggone year also. But we had some good ball players, and of course one of the things that made our football team was the fact that George Allen basically was a defensive coach, and instead of just being, you know, the head coach, he spent a lot of time with his defensive players.
And now, was he the defensive coordinator for the team? Did he call the defense, or did he delegate that to somebody else and just kind of oversee it?
No, he. Let me tell you something. We didn't have the phones in our helmets and stuff like that at that time. We had guys like Jack Pardee and Maxie Bond, who actually did the signal calling.
Yeah. Oh, and Jack Pardee went on to be a very good head coach, too, in the NFL.
Yes, he did. He was a good one.
Now, the thing that always upset me about that team is you guys beat Green Bay, you beat Dallas, you're 13-1. I mean, I think you guys finished two or three games ahead of Green Bay, but you had to go to Green Bay for a playoff game. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was. I think the playoff game was something like, the temperature, I believe, was something like 5 or 6 degrees above zero when the game started, and the time it was over, it was about six degrees below zero. And, you know, we didn't have heating facilities on the sidelines in those days, and that hurt us quite a bit, I think. Of course, coming from California, Southern California, where you got great temperature, you know, at the end of the winter season.
Yeah.
We didn't, and they, of course, it would have been great if they would have come out, had played in Los Angeles and came out there and played in 70 or 80 degree weather too, because that was just a reverse.
Yeah, because I think they did just a few weeks earlier and you guys beat them down there.
Yeah, right. So anyway, that was a good one.
And, I mean, You also look at the 1969 team, another great team, lost a tough Western Conference playoff game in Minnesota after having led most of the game. What do you remember about that game?
I guess what I remember most of all is probably the weather again, which was similar to what it was in Green Bay, and it was the field was just like playing on concrete. Actually, the ground was frozen and all that. But and I guess they were more used to that than we were from the West Coast.
Now with the Rams, I mean, you were with a couple guys that are basically Hall of Fame coaches. You also played behind the fearsome foursome, one of the greatest defensive lines of all time. What was it like to be on that defense and to know that, I mean, number one, it's got to make your job as a DB easier because you know you don't have to wait or you don't have to cover as long as most guys. But you want to speak on the fearsome foursome a little bit?
Well, the four of them together were just fantastic. You watch the game films and the things that they did, get to the quarterback and so forth, was just unbelievable. And it was just, I feel real fortunate to have been able to play during that period of time and to play behind those guys. Because it was, like you say, you didn't have to stick with your receivers as long as normal, and because the quarterback was going to go down if he did.
Yeah.
And but anyway, that was super, super football back those days.
Well, and the thing that impressed me the most when I did a little bit more research on you to find out a little bit more was it seems to me those guys felt the same way about you, because I saw a quote from Merlin Olsen who said, "Eddie was one of the finest defensive backs I've ever seen, outstanding in coverage, fierce tackler, had a remarkable nose for the ball that allowed him to come up with big plays again and again. During his career with the Rams, he was also a fine leader and one of my favorite teammates." Merlin Olsen, a part of that fearsome foursome, made that comment. And, I mean, what's a comment like that mean to you as a football player and a man?
Well, it's fantastic as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not sure that I was as good as all he was talking about. But because I think if it hadn't been for those four guys up front, I would probably not have been near as effective as I was.
But, yeah,
we just had super camaraderie, if you want to call it that.
Yeah,
both on defense and on offense, and George Allen was right in the middle of it, the whole thing. So I got to give him an awfully lot of credit on it.
So your final season was 1970. What led to your retirement?
I didn't hear that.
I said your final career, final year was 1970. What led you to retire after that season?
Oh, well, I had actually wanted to retire after the 69 season, but George talked me into coming back and playing another year. And basically, and George Allen, as you know, I'm sure, and I read a lot about him, he liked older ball players.
Yeah.
Clear players with experience, and I guess he felt that I would have probably been one of the oldest ones back there. And he just smooth talked me into coming back. That's what he did.
I think he smooth talked Jack Pardino. He was almost 40 into coming back every year.
Hey, right.
All right. So after retirement, what'd you do after retirement? And was it a tough adjustment?
I had quite a bit going in California. Had a partner and everything out there. We were in a real estate business, and we were investing in real estate, building office buildings and apartment complexes and so forth. And so I had actually a full-time job doing that. But then again, I had another offer from my old college coach down in Texas, and he had he and another one of my classmates in college and basketball players, he and his name was Bo Adams, and Sam Heisman was a college coach, and they had started a life insurance company in Denton, Texas, called Lifetime Security Life Insurance Company. And they talked me, they put me on the board of directors, and I got familiar with what, you know, was going on, how you build an insurance company and so forth. And so I had a partner in California that he was in that business, and he said, well, listen, you go on to Texas and get that started down there, and I'll take care of what's going on in California. So I did, and I worked there with the insurance company for about 3 years, and I decided that I really didn't like that particular business, and so I started going to gun shows and knife shows and things of that nature. And my wife had been a jewelry buyer in Dallas for a number of years, and she talked me into, let's go to gun shows and sell jewelry at them. And I said, okay. So we did. And then after about 6 or 8 months, we had somebody says, why don't you go to horse shows and sell your jewelry? And I said, horse shows? They buy jewelry at horse shows? And so I did. I went to the first horse show that I went to was in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it was the Arabian horse show out there. And we had a lot of jewelry, but it was actually jewelry that was bought, you know, through stores at wholesalers.
You bought it from other people and then went and resold it.
Yeah, and so consequently, I thought, well, you know, we can't. These people want some horse jewelry, so they can represent. They can wear it and represent something that that they own and that they're showing. So we began to actually build our own jewelry, and that's exactly what we started 25 years ago, and that's what we
did. It's a lot better right than now. Selling life insurance, isn't it, Eddie?
You better believe it.
Yeah. Plus, you get to spend more time with your wife, too.
Right, that's for sure. Yeah, we have met some super, super people in the horse business. And I used to travel a lot going to different horse shows all over the United States. And I've kind of stopped that and basically just do horse shows in Lexington, Virginia. We have a super horse park there.
Now, do you have a website where you sell jewelry or anything, or just basically at the horse park?
Oh, yes, we sure do. We got, it's called The Gorgeous Horse, and we've got a tremendous website there, and you can just take a look at that and see what kind of work that we actually do.
So that's www.gorgeoushorse.com?
That's it.
Yep. All right, make sure everybody checks that out. Go ahead, keep talking about it if you want. Plug away, Eddie.
Okay. And my grandson actually handles the web page and everything on the internet, and I'm trying to get out of as much of it as I possibly can, you know.
Just, yeah.
I quit the traveling 3 years ago, I'm just sitting around taking orders, actually, from my wife, you know.
Don't we all, Eddie? That's not
yeah.
just you.
Really. But we do have a shop right here on the premises, and we actually make the jewelry, and I give it to my grandson, and we have some other wholesalers. We wholesale to several other people too, and so. But anyway, take a look at our gorgeous horse, and by golly, I think we have the Arabian line of horses, saddlebred line of horses, draft horses, quarter horses, just about any of them that you want.
Yeah. Well, make sure everybody checks that out, gorgeous horse.com, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right, so do you still watch the NFL today, Eddie?
Not a whole lot. I do as much as I can. Like the horse shows, for example.
Yeah, horse shows are on the weekends, probably, right?
On the weekends, but yes, in the past couple of 3 years now, I have watched it a lot more than I did before. But
so, what's your opinion on today's NFL compared to when you played?
Well, I think that there's no question about the fact that they're bigger and stronger and faster than they were in my day. And I'm kind of disappointed in some of the things that go on nowadays in the NFL.
Yeah.
Because to me, a person in the National Football League needs to be straighten himself out before he gets into it.
Yeah.
And
I think a lot of the problems anymore, Eddie, is these guys are babied from the time they're 8 or 9 and show that kind of ability. So I think a lot of it even goes on high school and college coaches anymore for putting up with that kind of behavior.
Oh, there's no question about that. Yeah, there sure is.
Now, what's your feeling on the – what did you say? Sorry about that.
I say, and again, too, the amount of money that these players make nowadays is just it's just unbelievable. I don't blame them. That's not a point, but I do feel like that there's a lot of old retired players that...
Man, you knew what my next question was going to be, Eddie.
Yeah, I knew you would get down to that. But I was a player representative for the Rams for a number of years, and we fought and fought and fought to get even a retirement program going for retired players.
Yeah.
And so finally we did, and I don't mind telling you that I spent 12 years in the National Football League, and my retirement today is about $1,800 a month.
Now, which you're basically the sweat of you guys in from the 30s through the 60s, 70s, is what built this billion-dollar corporation, which gives you $1,800 a month.
That's right. That's it in a nutshell.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of former players. We've had guys on that, Matt Blair, George Visger, guys like that, that have medical problems, they're disabled, and it takes them forever to get the NFL just to approve them for disability.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's
so. And I think the
really
sad thing is, with the money they make, that's probably never going to change.
Yeah, it's just...
Not until the players that are playing today realize that someday they're going to be older, too.
And I want to see that day.
No, yeah, because we all know if you're 25, 30 years old, you're playing in the NFL, you don't think anything bad's ever going to happen to you.
Yep, that's for sure.
Man, you think you're going to play forever, and it never works out that way.
Well, I just got out of the hospital, to give you an example, and of course, I'm on Medicare and all that, but I found out that, it's been a year ago now that I had somehow a broken back. I never knew that I had a broken back.
Yeah.
But now when I think about it, I can remember my last year, I don't even remember who we were playing football at that time, but whoever the running back that I had him, I was sitting on my behind, and I had him around the knees, and here come Deacon Jones, man, and he flattened both of us out, and my back popped like a shotgun, and I thought, and I went ahead and played the ball game. I didn't really realize. Guess what? And that may not have been what happened to me, but I that's the only thing I can remember.
Yeah, good chance. And a good thing you didn't let George Allen talk you back into playing in 1971. Because who knows how that could have turned out then, you know?
that's for sure.
But anyway. Eddie, we're almost out of time. I really appreciate you coming on the show. It was an absolute honor. I mean, the reason we do the NFL Legends show is there's a lot of great players like yourself, the Robert Brazils, that younger people don't realize even played back then, and they don't realize how great they were. And, I mean, I think when I started the show, it said you're one of the greatest defensive backs in NFL history. I mean, you still hold, what, 5 or 6 records from the Rams even to this day?
I think so.
Yeah, so I mean, that says a lot when you're setting records and 50 years later they're still there.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So definitely an honor to have you on. Anytime you want to come back, or I would love to have you anytime you want to come on.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and good luck to everyone listening out there.
Yeah, and give them that website for your jewelry one more time.
The Gorgeous Horse, that's it.
The Gorgeous Horse, so make sure you check that out. So make sure you check us out on the Grueling Truth Facebook page. Check us out on Twitter, at Grueling Truth. Our guests over the next week or so, we'll have J.J. Burdan, former Kansas City wide receiver, Bruce Reimers, Jim McNally from the 88 Super Bowl team, the Cincinnati Bengals, Kerry Glenn, former Dolphins defensive back, Toy Cook, who was a starter, intercepted a pass, Super Bowl 29. So make sure you check all that out. Check out our sponsor, Gridiron Mo, www.gridironmo.com. Plus, check out Eddie's, www.thegorgeoushorse.com. So for Eddie Meter, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.
Thank you.
Nya, nya, nya.